It is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Kane Sea.
Thank you, Kane. Thank you.
Thanks for the job on the auction. My name is Kane Crawford. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to God and to Alcoholics Anonymous for my sobriety and for my life. I want to thank everybody here for the privilege. My friend David, the flyers were not a misprint. David was supposed to be your speaker. He's a friend of mine. He's had cancer in his jaw, and he's taken a turn for the worse. He was supposed to get all new teeth and have everything rebuilt, and it's not working out for him. And so he was not able to be with you tonight. He asked me to please extend his, you know, his deepest regrets to all of you that he wasn't able to be here. He called me and asked if I'd be willing to do it. And we had such a great time. We came up last time. I said, of course, I'd be happy to. So if you've heard me before, feel free to just fall asleep, and we'll let you know when we're ready to leave. You'll probably know because the karaoke will start and the just the noise alone will wake you up. But it's a joy to be back someplace. I don't know about any of you, but at the end of my drinking, I wasn't being invited back very many places. So it's kind of nice to be welcomed back. And again, the hospitality has been fabulous, and we really appreciate that. The auction was a lot of fun. Thank you again, Brent, for that. And Tim, thank you for a great magic show. That was a lot of fun. Thank you all. I love telling people that you auction off German chocolate cakes for hundreds of dollars. They just look at me like I'm some kind of a lunatic. And I said, well, you've never had our German chocolate cake. It's worth every penny. But I just love that everybody is so anxious and willing to participate. That means a lot to me. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the fact that I'm still here. My sobriety date is August the 18th, 1990. My home group is the Great Reality Meeting at Stepping Stones in Santa Clarita on Sunday morning at 9 a.m. If you're ever there, please join us. We read pages 54 and 55 from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It talks about where and how to find God. That's why it's my home group. I have a very meaningful relationship to me with my God, and I'm so grateful for that. I found that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not that I didn't believe God existed, I just didn't have the same relationship that I have built here. My sponsor is Craig Randall. Craig has 49 years sober. He'll be 50 in April, and he is my fourth sponsor. Two of the three before him passed away, and I've never been without a sponsor for more than a week or two in the entire 28 plus years that I've been sober. It's very important in my life to have somebody that I can check myself with when I think I have a really good idea. If you're new, for those of you who identified with less than a year, please, please share your good ideas with us. We can always use a good laugh, and we sincerely appreciate it. So please share your good ideas with us so we can enjoy them as much as you will someday. If you've heard me before, you're probably in the majority here. I've spoken at the breakfast meeting also, and so I love it up here. I love coming up. I love you guys. It's always a joy to participate, and I really enjoy myself. I will tell you this. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad was an alcoholic. My uncle was an alcoholic. Both grandfathers were alcoholics. My grandmother on my mother's side was an alcoholic. There's plenty of alcohol to go around in my family. I grew up swearing I was never going to take a drink because I saw what it did to my dad. I was firsthand. I was the oldest kid in an alcoholic home, so Mom would say, you know, come and help me clean up the bathroom or get Dad ready for church or whatever and be Mommy's little helper. And that's what I was for most of the first 7 years of my life. And I grew up swearing I'm never going to take a drink of alcohol because I saw what it did to my dad. My dad's story goes something like this. He was married three times. He wrecked three cars. He needed to get sober. He was 39 years old. So I'm not going to turn out like him. will not happen. I'm not going to do it. My mom had warned me. She'd poke her finger in my chest and say, if you don't cut it out, you're going to turn out just like your father. And I am not going to turn out like that man. Now, I'll tell you my story in a nutshell. I was married three times. I wrecked three cars. And I got here when I was 39 years old. If you don't think God's got a sense of humor, hang on a second and watch. I'm pretty sure God is like a cosmic comedian and we're his material. He's up there going, Jesus, come here, watch this. No, come here, come here. He's going to do it again. And Jesus goes, come on, Dad. And he goes, it's not me, it's him. Come here, hurry up. And we never, you know what I love about alcoholics? We never don't. We never go, wait a minute, that didn't go well yesterday. I'm not going to do that again. We don't ever do that. We just charge at it and we over and over and over and over and over and over again. You will hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've heard it 1,000 times. I don't argue with the definition, but it just doesn't work for me. They'll say the definition of insanity is doing the same thing, expecting different results. Not for me, it's not. The definition of insanity for me is doing the same thing, knowing exactly what's likely to happen, and I can't not do it. I can no more stop myself from doing what I know is going to be disastrous. I can't. I wish I could. If I could, I wouldn't be here. That's for sure. I can't do it. There are normal people out there that can. I don't understand that. There are people out there who will order a margarita and pay $11 for it and drink a third of it. Pay the check, and then start to the car. I still want to chase him to the door and say, get back here and finish that drink. That's $11. Are you out of your mind? Still, I mean, I still see that, and it just, I bristle. That's me. That's who I am. That's what an alcoholic is. So I'm never going to take a drink. Now, here's my fundamental problem. I don't know that this is my fundamental problem. I have no idea because I'm 7 years old. But it talks about it in the doctor's opinion. I'll get to that in a minute. My fundamental problem is that I want to feel on the inside like you look to me on the outside. That's what I want. That's all I want. I don't think that's too much. I want to feel on the inside like you looked on the outside. The problem with that is that I have a diseased brain as far back as I can remember that changes the rules as we go. And I don't know that that's what it's doing. I'll give you an example. When I was in high school, I was probably in 10th or 11th grade, and one of my friends got a date with a cheerleader. And pretty soon he's walking around the quad and he's happy and they're holding hands and he's carrying her books and he's happy as he can be. I thought, if I could get a date with a cheerleader, I'd be happy too. So I asked the cheerleader out, and she said yes, which blew me away, but that's great. I'm well on my way now. So I take a cheerleader out, and we're 45 minutes into the date, and I realize I've asked the wrong cheerleader, because I'm not feeling anything like he looks. Now, I don't know about any of you, but all my life, people have been saying to me, what is wrong with you? And now I'm in high school and I'm asking myself that question. What is wrong with me? And I don't have an answer. Now, it's in the big book. What's wrong with me is in here. In the doctor's opinion, it describes it perfectly. It says the alcoholic is restless, irritable, and discontented. Thus, he can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. It's right there in the book. It's in the doctor's opinion. Pretty meaningful. I wish I'd known that, because then when I'm sitting in the principal's office again, and again, and again, and again, and again, and he says, what's wrong with you? I could have said, well, I'm restless, irritable, and discontented, unless I can begin to experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. He'd have pulled a bottle out of his drawer and have a drink and get out of my office. I don't know what happened, when it happened. I don't know any of that. I will tell you this. The fact that my father is an alcoholic did not make me an alcoholic. The fact that I grew up in the home that I grew up in did not make me an alcoholic. What made me an alcoholic is that when I took the first drink I took, I could no longer accurately predict my behavior or when it was all going to end. Period. From the very first drink. Now, it talks in this book about an invisible line. I am not an invisible line drunk. Shortly after I graduated from high school, I went up to a place Valley Lake. It's up by Big Bear. That is not me doing that, just so you know. I'm not all of a sudden. It was not me. I don't know what's going on here, but this microphone doesn't seem to like us much. So I go up to Green Valley Lake with a buddy of mine. I was a swimmer in high school. He was a runner. They have this carnival up there, and they have swimming races and running races and a flea market and a volleyball tournament. And I think, you know what? Here, I got a great plan. I'm going to win the swimming race. You're going to win the running race. We'll both get a girl. I saw it on Leave It to Beaver. It works. I know it works because I saw it. It's got to work. Well, I finished fifth. When you finish fifth, you don't get a girl. You don't get nothing. You get a guy says, hurry up, get out of the water. We got another race. That's what you get when you finish fifth. That's all you get. And that doesn't do anything for the girls. The girls are already with the guy who finished first. And I don't know. I don't know if there are girls there. I have no idea. What I do know is that that's how it made me feel. So now we're up at the campgrounds made a fire and we got Pepsi and I'm playing my guitar. And I looked on the other side of the campgrounds and there was some guys over there with a much better fire than mine. Figures. I can't even make a good fire. So we walked over into their campground. The guy says, why don't you go get something to drink and join us? Well, because I don't drink. That's what I should have said. That's what I promised myself when I was a little. I will never, ever turn out like him. I don't drink. That's what should have come out of my mouth. That's not what came out of my mouth at all. I walked over to the liquor store right outside the campgrounds. I gave some old guy, probably about Keith's age, I gave him $2. Came back out with two bottles of Boone Farm wine. Two bottles. One for me, one for my friend. Now, we talk about an invisible line. Let me tell you what I did when I got my Boone's Farm wine. I took the cap off the bottle, threw the cap in the fire. I won't be needing that anymore. Wait a minute. I've never tasted this stuff. I don't know what it tastes like. I don't know what it does. How do I know I'll not be needing that anymore? There's something here. My friend didn't do that. He took the cap out, put it in his pocket in case. Not me. If I'm gonna, let's go. Now, I start drinking the wine, and halfway through that first bottle, I qualified to be here tonight because I had my first alcoholic thought. I didn't know that's what it was. My first alcoholic thought was this. Wow, if a half a bottle does that, wait till I'm done. And now, I've never had a drink 15 minutes ago, and now I'm drinking with a purpose. I don't know where I'm going, and I can't wait to get there. Let's go. So I'm drinking that bottle, and I finish my Boone's Farm wine. I slam it in the fire. It goes, because there's still a little alcohol in there. The guys clap me on the back, and they're laughing. And my friend took the cap out of his pocket, started putting it back on his bottle, which was not yet empty. I said, don't do that. Let me help you out. And I helped him. Then I helped my new friends. And I got up the next morning, and I didn't know what a blackout was. I found out the next morning because I got up and started throwing up stuff I didn't eat. And if you have ever thrown up stuff you didn't eat, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Normal people go, oh yeah, dinner. Yeah, that's what that is. Okay. I don't even like beef jerky. Where did that come from? And I don't have any idea. I had my second alcoholic thought. I thought strawberry wine makes me sick. I'm never drinking that again. And as far as I know, I never did. Because they make peach and I don't know. They make all kinds of flavors. From the middle of that summer until 1990, I was a daily drunk. Now, upshot of all this, my dad, the bad alcoholic, the guy who had wrecked three cars and was married three times, he got sober in February of 1968. In February of 1969, before I ever had a drink, I handed him a cake for 1 year. Didn't hear a word in that meeting because I'd never had a drink. Why would I even bother to listen? You don't have anything to say to me. I wish I'd listened. I really do. I had 21 years of hard road ahead of me that I didn't know about. I went out there and I had to live my life. I went back to that meeting every year for the next 21 years and I handed him a cake drunk. There's a little liquor store around the corner from that clubhouse and I'd stop at that little liquor store and I'd get a six pack of tall boys. I'd drink three of them on the two blocks to the house, to the hall and three of them on the way back to the liquor store to get some more to drive home. And that's what I did for 21 years. And I'd walk into that club. A little lady named Alabama had come up and put her hand on my arm and say, honey, it's going to be all right. And I didn't know what she was talking about because it's all right now, lady. Nothing wrong with me. I'm not here for me. I'm here for him. And I'd hand him a cake and I wouldn't hear a word. I did the things we do. I went and I got married. I got married the first time and I had a baby. And my wife left me before that baby turned 2 years old because I wasn't a father. I wasn't a husband. I wasn't anything. I was a provider. That's all. I brought home a paycheck and I thought that was enough. And I did what I wanted when I wanted to do it. And if it interfered with her and her life or anything else, it was just too bad. I'm bringing home a paycheck. That's got to be good enough. And she wasn't good enough for her, and it wasn't good enough for my baby. I'm not proud of that. That's who I become when I drink. I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it, the way I want to do it. And if you get in my way, that's something I'm willing to give up. I did that. She moved. She actually left the state. She moved far enough away that she knew I couldn't get in touch with her or that boy or anything else. I saw my son the last time. I saw him when he was 18 years old. I made amends to him and he said, he was less than 2 years old when he left. He didn't know who I was. I was not a father to him. And he said, thank you very much. I appreciate that, but I have a dad. And that was his stepfather. And I don't blame him. I wish it could be different? Of course I do. But I don't blame him for making that decision. I did a lot of stuff that was really ugly, really reprehensible. A lot of stuff I'm not real proud of. But I have to share it with you. I have to become transparent enough to tell you the truth. Because there's also healing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have to tell you about that. I got married the second time. My second wife had two boys. They were 5 and 7 when I met her. They were 10 and 12 when she died. She had a heart defect. She couldn't have children. They were both adopted. Their dad came to me when she passed and he said, the boys have been with you almost as long as they were with me. I think we should let them decide where they want to live. So I cleaned myself up for 12 sessions with the psychiatrist. And I put on the dog and pony show. And I suited up and I showed up and I sounded right and I acted right. And at the end of 12 sessions, the psychiatrist says, I think the boys want to and should stay with Cain. Now, I'd like to stand here and tell you that I rewarded their trust and devotion with love. Truth is, I rewarded their trust and devotion with terror. I physically, emotionally, and mentally abused those boys from that day until my oldest son went into the United States Army July 31st, 1990. 19 days before I got sober, he ran into the United States Army to get away from me. I don't blame him for that. He made a decision to find his birth family, and neither his brother or his grandparents or me have talked to him since. And it's unfortunate, but that's his decision, and he's welcome to that decision. I continue to send him, I send him emails every birthday and Christmas and Father's Day and try and reconnect, and it just, they always go on, they fall on empty ears, and there's nothing I can do about that. I don't love him any less than my other two sons. I don't love him any differently. He just made a decision and wants nothing to do with any of us. It breaks his younger brother's heart. The younger brother was still living at home, and like I said, I got sober on August the 18th, 1990. I told you I was a car wrecker. I was a blackout. I was actually a really good blackout driver. I drove blacked out almost every day for 21 years and only wrecked 3 cars. And I wrecked the first 2 in the first year. Then I went 20 years blacked out without a wreck. That's really good blackout driving. A lot of you can't say you've gone 20 years without a wreck sober. So, you know, come on. A little credit here. I'm an excellent blackout driver. The problem, I don't know if we got any other blackout drunks here, blackout drivers. The problem I had with that is that every time I blacked out and wrecked a car, the cops showed up, which is really troublesome because cops are inquisitive, you know, and when you're coming out of a blackout, you don't have a lot of answers. You know, they say things like, what happened here? I don't know, sir. I just got here, too. I wish I could help you. I really don't have any idea. Then they say, well, is this your car? My car wasn't wrecked when I left the house. Look, if it is, I'll sell it to you cheap, okay? Then they're sneaky. They're sneaky. Cops are sneaky. They ask trick questions. They say, were you driving? I didn't come in the cop car. I don't know. You know, it occurred to me, I was telling that story one time I was talking, and I thought to myself, you know, I could have lied. I could have said, no. He said, who was? Oh, you just ran off.
If you hurry, you can catch him. It wouldn't have gone for it, but it would have been fun to see if they tried. I don't know. So, August the 18th, 1990 was no different than any other day. I'm going to tell you a story that for me is a perfect example of the insanity of alcoholism, of what it does to me when I'm in my disease. And I don't know about you, but this is a true story. I had had a little bit of an adventure in 1989. Actually, I'm going to tell you about it. 1989, it was a Sunday morning, and I got up in the morning, and I played softball on Sundays every year for many, many years. And so I get up on Sunday morning, which comes really close on the heels of Saturday night, if you don't have a calendar with you. But it's what that means is when I get up on Sunday morning, usually I'm still drunk. Okay, let's just be honest. I drink enough that when I get up on Sunday morning, I'm still drunk. And now what I need to do is take the edge off a little. So on the way to softball, I stop and I get a 12-pack and I drink a few of them before I get there. And now I'm ready to play softball. So we get done with softball and I finish the 12-pack and we go to my friend's house to have a little swim party. It's the end of the season and have a little swim party, and the Lakers playoff game is on TV. And so we're going to have a little swim party and a barbecue, and then we're going to watch the Laker playoff game. And so we're at his pool at the back of his house, and there's this kid there I've never seen before. So it's really important to impress this kid because he's never seen me before and he doesn't know how bitchin' I am. And so I said, "Hey kid, watch this. I'm pretty sure that the most common two words right before, oh my God, call 911 is watch this." And most of the time, it's an alcoholic who says, "Watch this." So I said, "Watch this." And I dove into the shallow end of my friend's swimming pool and misjudged the bottom by a little. And I put 43 stitches in the top of my head and snapped C6 and C7 clean through. I broke my neck. And I grabbed my head and I said, "Oh my God, I think I broke my neck." And they said, "You couldn't have broke your neck. You couldn't walk if you broke your neck." And I said, "I got blood in my mouth. Give me a beer." And so they did, and I went like this. And I went, "No, I think I broke my neck." So they call 911, and 911 gets there, and they lay me out on the backboard, and they strap me down. And the one guy looks at the other and says, "I think he broke his neck." And I thought, yes, I knew I broke my neck. Only an alcoholic is vindicated by a broken neck. A normal person goes, "Oh my God, I broke my neck." Not me. I'm going, "Yeah." I've still got a year to go, people. What is wrong with me? So I get to the hospital and they lay me in and they bring in this world-renowned orthopedist, and he tickles my foot and he says, "Can you feel that?" And I said, "Yes." He tickles my abdomen. He says, "Can you feel that?" And I said, "Yes." And he looks at the x-ray again and he looks at me. He says, "I don't understand it. I've seen people hurt not even half as bad as you. Will never move again from the neck down." You know what I thought in 1989? With another year to go before I get sober. You know what I thought? "It's a good thing I'm big and strong." Where's God? There is no God for me. I'm God. Don't you know who I am? I'm big and strong. It's a good thing. Please. I'll tell you today what happened. God reached down, pulled me up by the heel and says, "I'm not done with you. Get up." And I had another year to go. August the 18th, 1990, I get off work, and I'm going to go to Sauga Speedway, where they got racing, and I'm a huge racing fan, loved it, many, many years, season ticket holder. I'm only going to have two big beers. I'm going to be there from 2 o'clock until 11 o'clock. I'm only going to have two big beers. That's just, two 32-ounce beers over a 7-hour period, I'll be fine. That's all I'm going to have. Here's the insanity of this disease. I stopped at the 7-Eleven on the way to the racetrack. I'm telling myself this as I stop at the 7-Eleven. I go into the 7-Eleven, I buy a styrofoam cooler, a 12-pack of beer, bag of ice, I put that in the back of the truck. For who? Who is that for? What? What just happened? What just happened? And I don't even know that I'm doing that. It's just, it's completely an unconscious thing. I get done with the races, and the last thing I remember is I stopped at a little AMPM and I bought two more tall boys for the drive home. The next thing I know, I'm standing in the driver's window of my truck. I'm not a mechanic, but I'm smart enough to know that if I can stand in the driver's window, there's something wrong with the truck. And I thought, oh, this is not good. I mean, look, the glove box doesn't even belong there. Let's just be honest. That is not where the glove compartment's supposed to be. And I'm standing in the window, and pretty soon the passenger door opens and this guy looks in. He said, are you all right? And I said, yeah, I'm fine, thanks. Who is he and where did he come from? So he helps me up out of the truck. Now I'm sitting up on the running board and he's standing down in the street. I still don't know who he is or why he's there or where he came from or where I am or what happened. I know nothing. So I said, the only thing that made sense to me to say is I said, what happened? And he said, you just hit us head on. And I had turned the truck up the driver's door and spun it around backwards, so he never even saw it coming. The headlights were facing the same way as he was. And I slid into him. Next words out of my mouth changed my life. I told you I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous for 21 years now. 22, actually. Handing my dad a cake every year. Next words out of my mouth were, I said, are you all right? And he says, I think we're okay. I said, God help me, I can't do this anymore. First time in my life that I was honest with myself. That's the first time in my life I said that foxhole prayer from my heart instead of from my brain. I meant that. God, I cannot do this again. Somewhere in that moment, and I don't know, you know, I mean, it was literally in a moment. I came to the understanding, the realization that that day I had done the very best I could. If I could have done anything different, I would have done it different, and I no longer had that power. It says we lack the power of choice in drink. I could do nothing different than what I did. And I knew that in that moment. I said, God help me, I can't do this anymore. The cops showed up and they said, have you been drinking? I said, yes. They said, how much have you had? I said, I don't know. They said, are you drunk? And I said, yes. They put me in handcuffs and put me in the back seat of their car, and then they started investigating the accident. They took the wheelie dealie out of the back of their car and they measured the only thing they could find to measure because there was no skid marks. Apparently, I think I'm a good enough driver blacked out that I was never alarmed enough to hit the brakes. So they measured the only thing they could find to measure, which was a scrape on the asphalt, evidently made by the front bumper as it slid down the street. And they measured that scrape, and it was 600 feet long. That's 2 football fields that truck slid down the street. They estimated I was going in excess of 80 miles an hour when I hit that man. When I flipped the truck, not when I hit him. I don't know how much I'd slowed down. I have no idea. I don't even know how damaged his vehicle was. 80 miles an hour. One of the cops that night said, you should be dead. That truck was folded in half. I mean, it was literally, they dragged it up onto the flatbed on both bumpers. Neither set of tires would even touch the flatbed. They just dragged it up on the bumpers. I should have been dead. I'm pretty sure every time I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm pretty sure that I'm surrounded by people with very similar stories. In the respect that almost every one of us has been right here with death at least once. 7 times I was told by medical or law enforcement professionals, you should be dead. 7 times. This wasn't the first time, this was the last time. You should be dead. I should have been killed that day when I dove into that swimming pool. I should have drowned. I should have broken my neck and drowned. Real simple. How was I not killed any of those 7 times? How am I still here, reasonably sound of mind and body? How is any of that possible except by the grace of a loving God? I sincerely believe that. I had a friend who passed a number of years ago. I loved her dearly. And she used to say, God started working in my life a long time before I ever invited Him. And I believe that's what happened for me. I believe that God started working my life a long time before I ever asked Him in. Went to Alcoholics Anonymous because it's the only place I know to go. I went to the only meeting I thought there was in the entire San Fernando Valley. I mean, it's 2.5 million people in the San Fernando Valley. And I thought there was one meeting in Toluca Lake on Sunday night, and that's where all 50 of them went. That's honestly, I thought I was that unique. I mean, so I go to that meeting. I drive all the way across the valley from Chatsworth, and I go to that meeting because it's the only place I know to go. Secretary got up there and said, if you're new here, don't leave here tonight without a big book and a directory. She held this up and showed it to everybody and showed them a directory. So I walked up to her after the meeting. I says, I need a big book and a directory. She says, oh, are you new? Yeah. Nobody needs to know that but us. Like I think I'm fooling you guys. Like you don't have any idea that I'm the new guy. You could smell me when I walked in the door. I'm 24 hours from jail. So yeah, you have no clue. And so I thought so I get my big book and my directory. I get out to the car and I open it up. And sure, I mean, there's meetings right down the street from my house, which was good because the state of California took my license. They said, we'll keep this. You can have it back in 4 months. It's like, no, you don't understand. I drive for a living. I'm a mailman. I need my license. They said, that's fine. You'll have it back in 4 months. Yeah, that's what a DUI gets you. So I go off to Monday night, I go down the street from my house. There's a meeting right down the street from my house. So I go to that meeting. And I walk in at 8 o'clock because my directory said 8 o'clock. It said in the directory Monday night, 8 o'clock. So I walk in at 8 o'clock. The meeting's already going. I walk in the back door. It's a little schoolroom with square tables in the middle, chairs around the outside, and everybody in the room smoking 2 cigarettes at once. And if you've been here a while, you know I'm not lying. They're smoking them like they're giving them out at the door, and if you don't finish them, you got to give them back. And they are not giving any back. They say, and if the only time they're not smoking 2 cigarettes is if they need some coffee. Then they put one down real quick, they have some coffee, and they go right back to 2 cigarettes. I walk in the door and the guy, the meeting's already going on and the secretary's sitting up the front with the leader and the secretary hits the table. He says, excuse me, just 1 second. He stops the guy who's sharing. He points at me. He says, like to tell us who you are and the nature of your disease? And I thought, no, I don't like to tell you nothing. I can see I'm late. Just leave me alone. I got a directory. I'm not coming back here anyway. You start the meeting too early. So I sit down and at this particular meeting, everybody shares. There's about 35 people in the room. Everybody shares. So he comes around and says, okay, I'm Cain and I'm an alcoholic. And I share my sad tale of woe about how I lost my license. And they giggle a little bit. And I said, yeah, but I'm probably going to lose my job. I'm thinking, these people are nuts. That's not funny. This is tragic stuff, you know. And the more I talk, the harder they laugh. And now I'm angry and I can't wait to get out of here. And it's a good thing I got a directory in my pocket because I am never coming back here. So we get done with the meeting, we say the Lord's Prayer, and I like that because I know the words. It's kind of like karaoke. It's more fun if you know the words. And so I say the Lord's Prayer, and I say amen, and that's where the Lord's Prayer ends all my life until we get to Alcoholics Anonymous. And now the prayer goes on for a little while, and depends on where you go, how long it goes on. Some of these recovery places you go, it goes on for 15 minutes. I say, keep coming back. It works if you're working. If your butt falls off and you don't call your sponsor, I don't come crying to me. It's like, stop it. Who are you talking to? Prayer stops at amen. God stops listening at amen. Okay, so stop. God never stops listening. That's a joke. He always listens. So don't say, amen, I sure wish I was more patient. You'll be at the DMV every day for a week. I'm just going to tell you, don't do it. So I'm making a beeline for the door, which is hard because it's a little teeny schoolroom and they're not out of cigarettes yet. So nobody's moving. They're still standing there and they're finishing their coffee and they're talking about whatever they're talking about. I don't even know what they're talking about. They're talking about panels and they're talking about tomorrow. I don't know what they're talking about. Just get out of my way. So I'm trying to I'm going, excuse me. And this old guy steps in front of me, says, hi, I'm Ed. Like I care. I don't care who you are. But I stuck out my hand and said, hi, Ed, I'm Cain. And he goes, that's not how we do it in Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe what he had, a secret handshake I got to learn or something. But he hugged me and he held me. And he didn't do not one of those thump, thump, jump hugs like some guys do. But he hugged me and he held me. He said, "Welcome home." My wife hadn't hugged me like that in several months, so that was nice. He said, "I want you to do me a favor." Thinking, I don't know what you get for a hug. I don't know the tables yet, but what do you need? He says, "Tonight when you get home, I want you to get down on your knees and you thank God that I stayed sober today." Why would I do that? You're old. You're going to die soon anyway. What difference does it make? But I didn't say that. That's what I thought. And he must have seen that because he said it again. "Tonight when you get home, I want you to get down on your knees. You thank God that I stayed sober." He said, "I want you to do me another favor." I think, now you're pushing it for one hug. You're going to owe me or something. I don't know. He says, "Tomorrow morning when you get up, before you do anything, you ask God, 'Can I have one more day?'" Then he pulls a directory out of his pocket. "I don't already have one." Opens it to Tuesday. "So I'll see you here tomorrow night." I said, "I'm busy tomorrow night." He said, "Let me ask you a question. If I'd been smart, I'd have run screaming into the night before I ever let him ask me a question. Every time he said, 'Let me ask you a question,' I ended up doing something I did not want to do." He said, "Let me ask you a question. You drink every day?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Then you have to go to a meeting every day." I want to see the rule book. There's no rule book, just in case you're wondering. If you're new here, no rule book. We make them up as we go along. Get used to it. That's how it works. So, okay, if that's what I got to do, that's what I got to do. So I go to the meeting tomorrow night. It's a men's stag in a trailer park by the airport. Okay, it doesn't get much worse than that. I used to speed up to go by that place when I'm drunk, and now I'm pulling in to stay. They go, "Oh, goody." I go in. The secretary is starting the meeting. He said, "Before we start the meeting, we have an order of business. We need to elect an intergroup rep." I'm not paying attention because I'm brand new and I don't even know what an intergroup rep is. Ed raises his hand. He says, "I nominate Kane." I'm pretty sure I'm the only Kane in this room. A guy across the table doesn't even know me. He says, "I second the nomination." What the hell happened? He doesn't even know me. Now I know he raised his hand and seconded it so he wouldn't have to do it. That's what we do here. Then the secretary says, "I move the nominations be closed." So apparently we've thrown Robert's Rules of Order out the window. We don't use that here. All in favor? Everybody but me said aye. So I said, "Wait a minute, what do I got to do?" They said, "You got to go to the intergroup meeting." I said, "When is it?" They said, "Tuesday." I said, "I can't go there Tuesday. I have to be here." They said, "Don't worry, it's at 6. You go there at 6, come here at 8, you give us a report." So yesterday I wasn't going to any meetings on Tuesday. Now I'm going to 2. What just happened? So I go to intergroup, and they got rules at intergroup. Say, "We have rules at intergroup. You must have 1 year to be an intergroup rep." My report's done. I'm ready to go back. So I go back at 8 o'clock. They say, "Do you have a report?" I says, "Yes." "Sorry to report, I cannot be your intergroup rep." Ed says, "Why is that?" I says, "You have to have 1 year." He says, "You tell them we don't care." "Tell them your own self we don't care." I said, "There's a sign right up there on the wall. It says, 'We care.'" He says, "Not about that." All right, you guys are crazy. All right, whatever. So then we go to Saturday Night Live. Saturday Night Live was in a hall just like this. Almost the same size, maybe a little deeper. We used to put tables just like this. 2 tables on each side. 4 tables and 8 chairs at each set of 2 tables. So there's tables and tables and tables and tables and tables and tables and chairs. And at every 2 tables, there's 8 chairs and 12 ashtrays. I don't smoke, so I don't get it, but there's apparently lots of people smoke quite a bit. So we're there at Saturday Night Live, and the meeting gets over, the speaker meeting, and I liked the speaker. He was funny, and I enjoyed it, and that was great. We get done, and Ed comes over to me, and he says, "Why don't you go ask the secretary if you can help?" So I did what I was told. I walked, hustled over to the secretary. Ed says, "I have to come and ask you if I can help." He says, "Why don't you pick up the ashtrays?" I said, "Because I don't smoke." He said, "We don't care." I'm thinking, why do you have that sign? You don't care about anything. You people are nuts. So I figure if I make enough of a production out of it, they won't let me do it. So I pick up the ashtrays and I bang them on the trash can and I throw them in the box. And so I'm going bang, clang, bang, clang, bang, clang. And Ed walks up and taps me on the shoulder. He says, "That's why they're aluminum, dummy. They don't break." How did he know I was trying to break them? What do? They send these guys to school or something? So I pick up the ashtrays, and that became my commitment. Then the next week, when I picked up the ashtrays, I wiped them with a paper towel before I put them in the box. The week after that, I brought a rag and a paper towel, and I wipe them with a wet rag and then dry them with a paper towel and put them in the box. That wasn't good enough, so the next week I brought an SOS from home, and I SOS'd them all out in the sink, and then I dried them and put them in the box. When I put out those ashtrays, you could eat out of those ashtrays. You know what happened? People started coming to Saturday Night Live for those ashtrays. Yeah, you weren't there. They did. What actually happened, and it's really cool, it happened with Intergroup. I was on the board at Central Office. I was the co-chair of Central Office after 3.5 years in Intergroup when I found out it was a one-year commitment. I had no idea that I could stop. They never told me that. They never tried to elect anybody else. They just let me keep doing it until I was on the board, and I went, "What do you mean a one-year commitment? You mean I could have stopped 2.5 years ago? And now I'm on the board and it doesn't matter." All of those things that they did made me a part of those meetings and made those meetings a part of me. When they would say, "Where are you going tonight?" I said, "I'm going to my meeting." You pick up any directory and try to find my meeting. That's not ever what it's called. The Saturday night meeting was Saturday Night Live. Where am I going on Saturday? I'm going to my meeting. Because I'm the coffee guy, or I'm the ashtray guy, or I'm the chair guy. We had a Friday night meeting in a little church. It was about a quarter of the size of this. We put 200 chairs in that room, and the fire department sign said 160. And you had to set them up exactly right. And there was a crew of four of us that all hung together at that Tuesday night meeting and Friday night and Saturday night. There's a bunch of guys. We were all sober together. I'm still friends with two of them to this day. One of them passed away. The other one, I don't know where he is. But we still see each other, and we still share those memories. And we would set up those chairs. And if they sent somebody to help us, no. You can help tear them down, but you can't help set them up because you don't know how. It was scientific. It was like we owned it. And it meant so much to me, you know. I started doing H&I work when I had less than a year sober. Actually, I started with 30 days. It was never my intention. It was that Monday night meeting with 30 days. I was at my 30th day. It was actually my 30th day. I was going to take my first chip. And I showed up. And Ed was there. He was always there before me. I don't know how he did that. It was like he stood at the corner and watched for me, and then he'd run in and wait, tapping his foot like I'm late, you know. Meeting started at 7:30. If I got there at 6:15, he's standing there like this. So I get there, and he says, "How'd you like to be secretary of the meeting?" I says, "I've only got 30 days, Ed." I says, "What? But Tony's the secretary." He says, "Tony drank." Oh, that's big. That's not good. I mean, Tony had like 4 months. He was like a god to me. I can't believe it. And I said, "No, that, you know, that's okay. We get somebody else." So he nominates me, and I end up secretary. I actually got even. When I got here, I didn't smoke, and I also didn't drink coffee. And at that particular meeting, the secretary makes the coffee. So I read the can and said, "For every 12 cups of coffee, you use one cup of grounds." So what's wrong? Don't get ahead of me here. So I take a coffee cup and I measure out, it's an 84 cup. So if for every 12, that's 7 times 12. So I took 7 cups of coffee. Used half of a 5-pound can of coffee for that pot that night. And it was like drinking paint. I mean, it was literally, you could hear it coming out of the thing. It was like plopping. And these guys who drink their coffee black are putting in sugar and tea and whatever they can find, you know. And by the middle of the meeting, you're all like this. It was great. It was just an honest mistake. I had never made coffee, so I had no idea. When I figured out what I'd done wrong, I started making really good coffee, and they made me coffee guy at Saturday Night Live pretty soon after that. So I made good coffee. But all of those things that I did made me really willing to do whatever was in here. This book is just, the steps are so incredible. So I start through my steps. Ed says, here's what we're going to do. He says, I want you to read steps 1, 2, and 3 in the 12 and 12 every day for 14 consecutive days. And if you skip a day, you got to start over. Well, by God, I am not going to skip a day. I'm not going to give him the satisfaction of seeing me start over. So I did it every day for 14 days. Now, I got to about 10, and I called him, and I said, Ed, I got it. He goes, you got what? I says, well, you know, you told me to read it over and over, and I've been reading it, and I got it. He goes, it seems to me you got 4 more days. Okay, so I did it for 4 more days, and we sat down, we did 1, 2, and 3. I said my third step, prayer at a little church in Canoga Park that's still there. I drive by it whenever I do. I look in at that little courtyard. It's a flagstone courtyard with a fountain, and that fountain is where I said my third step prayer. And I said my third step prayer and stood up, and Ed hugged me. He said, you've just been reborn. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I had no idea, because I had maybe 4 weeks sober, maybe 3-4 weeks sober, because every day for 14 days, and then we're moving on. Ed didn't play. It wasn't a step a year or a step a month. And I'm not saying there's no right way, there's no wrong way to do these steps as long as you do them. I liken it to, it's almost custom made for each person who takes this book and goes through the steps. The same way as if tomorrow morning when the sun came up, we all met here and went on a 1-mile loop hike. And we're all going to do it, and we're all going to go together, and we're all going to go in a big group. We'd all come back from that hike with different stories. Different things that we experienced, different things we heard, smelled, whatever. We'd all have a little bit different experience with the exact same steps, the exact same path. And there'd be a little bit something for each of us that was unique and special for us. Some of us on the inside might never look to the outside, and some of us on the outside might never look to the inside. Now you've got two very different views. The steps are the same way. Unique to each of us. So I went through them very quickly because that's what I needed to do. And Ed knew that. And he took me through. We did 4 and 5. I wrote my 4th step. I showed up at his house on a Sunday. We sat down in his screen porch. He took it from me. He looked at it and he says, where's your boys? My boys? So why would I have my boys on there? I said, I got no beef with them. He said, then why do you abuse them the way you do? Because I've already told them my story. I said, that's discipline, Ed. He says, do me a favor. Take this into my kitchen in here. Go through those columns with your boys. I went through those columns and I found out that I was horribly resentful at them for interfering with my right to do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it the way I wanted to do it. And so I took it out on them. And I took it out on them with violence. Physically, emotionally, and mentally, those boys, for several years. Never sexually abused them. I've been told by my sponsor, I have to tell you that when I tell this story, because there's so many of us who have been victimized. He said, you'll hear their minds slam shut if you don't tell them. I never sexually abused them, but I physically abused them horribly. I'm not proud of that, but that's who I am when I'm drinking the way I want to drink. So I wrote that down and we went back in. We talked about it. We finished my 4th step. He said, I want you to sit here an hour. I want you to review what you've done to this point, just like it says in the book. I did that. We did. He says, now we're going to do it. Make a list of your grosser character defects because we don't have time for all of them. And I'm so grateful for that because what it tells you in the 12 and 12 is that the sixth step is a lifelong process. This is something we look at for the rest of our lives because there's still going to be times when I need to look at my behavior and my actions, my thinking, and reevaluate what needs to be taken. Said the seven-step prayer. When we got to that point, he says, now we're going to make a list of your amends. He says, get your four-step out. We got it out. We made a list. He says, you're going to start where you did the most damage. I said, at work. He says, no, at home. I don't want to start at home. Those are the hardest ones for me to make. I don't want to do it. But I'm going to tell you what. When I started at home and I made those amends to my now ex-wife and my youngest son who is still living at home and then my oldest son when he came home from basic training in October, when I made those amends at home, it made all the rest of them seem so trivial. So much weight was lifted off my shoulders. Got all the way through my steps. About 2 months later, my son called. We're talking one day. My youngest son is still at home, 16 years old at the time. And he says, could we start spending some time together? Well, now I'm at a loss because to be honest with you, I've never been an adult before and I don't know what to say to him. So I called Ed and I said, Ed, what do I do? He says, what night do you want? I says, I don't know. He said, well, why don't you ask him? I didn't know. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do anything. I am basically a 14 or 15 year old kid in a 39 year old body. That's what I am when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never had any adult experiences. I've drunk them away. I block them out. So he says, what night do you want? So I asked him and he said, how about Wednesdays? I called in. I says, how about Wednesdays? He says, call the secretary, find somebody to cover your commitment and have fun. What? It's that simple? So that's what I did. I found a friend to cover my commitment, and I took Wednesdays off, and I started spending them with my son. Here's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you just because it just blows me away. I was talking to somebody before we started tonight, and I mean this sincerely. I still forget sometimes to be amazed, but I want to not forget to be amazed. I want to not forget to be amazed by all of us sitting here tonight on New Year's Eve, celebrating together another year of success in a place that I never thought I'd be. Sober for 28 years. I mean, that's unbelievable to me. Over 10,000 days. That's crazy. That's just crazy to me. One at a time. I got invited to speak at a meeting up in Las Vegas. He lives in Henderson. When I go up there, I visit with him. I stay with him. This was about 8 years ago. He's 42 now. He's 34. So it's 8 years ago. I get invited. I said, you want to come to the meeting? He said, sure, I'll go with you. So he comes and he sits down front and I tell the story of the frightful abuse I put him through and he cries. And I tell the story of the healing of our relationship, spending time together and growing in our relationship and he cries. I went down afterwards and I hugged him and I said, are you all right? And he says, yes, if my story helps one person, please tell it. And so I continue to tell it because I owe it to him. I owe him that as part of my amends. And so I hugged him and I held him and we went back to his house later and we're sitting there on his couch and we're watching SportsCenter. Middle of the story, he mutes the TV. I said, what are you doing? I was watching that. He says, I have to ask you something. I says, ask me anything you want. He said, why'd you do it? I don't want to answer that. Because I know the answer. I know in my heart what the answer is. I said, I did it because I could. I did because I was bigger and stronger than you. I knew there was nothing you could do to stop me. I did it because I could. And my 34-year-old son started sobbing.
just started sobbing, and I slid over on the couch, and I took him in my arms, and I held him in my arms like I should have held him in my arms when he was 10 and his mother just died. When he was 10 and his mother just died, the best I could offer him, makes me sick to say this. This is who I was. The best I could offer him is, you got a game today, buddy. You still going to play? His mother died 2 hours ago. What is wrong with me? What will it make me look like if he doesn't play? Are you kidding? But that's where I go. I said, I did it because I could. He's just sitting there holding him and loving him, like I wish I could have done when he was 10. I didn't have anything to give him. You filled me up. You filled me up with love, with compassion, with tenderness, with everything that I value in my life. I sat there and I held him until he stopped crying, stroking his hair and just holding him. And as he stopped crying, I said, you know, if there's ever anything I can do to make it right, all you have to do is tell me what it is. He said, Cain, you already have. You can't get there from where I came from, except by the grace of a loving God. And that's enough. But the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I don't ever want to forget to be amazed. So I've been back to that same meeting about 4 more times. And each time he comes with me. And the last time I was up there was about 2 years ago. And he came with me. And I told my story. And as I was finishing up, he ran up on the stage and embraced me. And as we stood there embracing, the entire room stood and applauded. For us. Not for me and my son. For every one of you in this room tonight, for every person in every room that I've been in for 28 years, for everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous who has taught me to be the person that I've become. Now today I work in a high school with 400 incredibly amazing young people. And they come to me and they ask me questions and they ask counsel and they tell me what's going on with them and I make suggestions. And everything I tell them comes from here. They don't know that I'm sharing them with them the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's who I've become. I've become a big book thumping, card carrying member of this fellowship. I used to hate it when I was early in my recovery, and you'd be up there sniveling and whining about whatever's going on, and the old timers would say, the answer's in the book. Well, I looked in the book. I couldn't find it. Then you're asking the wrong question. What are you talking about? You're crazy. If you're new here, the answer's in the book. I'm sorry, but it always is. I don't know how they did that. This thing was written in 1935. I have no idea how they knew then what I was going to be thinking and doing now. But they did. I believe it was because God was shining on us from the very beginning. I believe that we are chosen. There used to be a little leaflet, why we were chosen. And basically what it said was, we were chosen because we can talk heart to heart with another alcoholic like no one else can. Not the church, not a minister, not anybody. Nobody else can do what we do. I got no beef with the church. And if you go to church every Sunday, good for you. I got no beef with the church. But if I went to the church and told them that I dove into a swimming pool and was proud that I broke my neck, they'd say, oh my God, you're crazy. Why would you do that? And if it almost killed you, why would you do it again? And you say, because it didn't. Why wouldn't I do it again? And they don't understand that. Here we do. When I say that, you laugh, you giggle, you snicker. That's what we do here. We share that. I love my life, my wife, my beautiful wife. I met her in Alcoholics Anonymous. She actually asked me out. She'll tell you she didn't, but she really kind of did. She kind of, because I'm such a catch, I guess. I don't know.
We were really friends, and it just kind of grew into a much more beautiful thing, and I'm really grateful for that. I'm so grateful for the gifts of recovery, the gifts of the life that I live. I got two amazing Christmas cards from two of the young men that are at my school this year. And both of them were just, I don't know who they're talking about. You know, I still know who I was. I still know who I was. And I don't recognize this guy that they're talking about on these cards. It brought tears to my eyes because they don't see any glimpse of that man. They just see the man I've become. And it's respect and it's admiration and it's, for lack of a better word, it's love. And I can't tell you how grateful I am for the love that I have in my life from the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, my family, my friends, these young people who don't even know that I'm teaching them what you've taught me for so many years. And that if they can do this, they'll have a life beyond their wildest imagination. But one young kid is just beyond brilliant. He's finished his college math and he's 17 years old. He just finished differential equations. There's nothing more to do in college math after that. He wants to be an engineer. He got accepted at Rochester Polytechnic Institute in a class of 200. And it's a very, very exclusive engineering school. And he came to me the other day and he says, I got accepted at RPI. And I said, good for you. And I hugged him. And he says, now I can go become an Imagineer. And I went, oh my God, I can't believe it. I was talking to him one day. He told me he wanted to be an engineer. I says, have you thought about this? And I told him about a friend of mine who started out as an engineer in construction and got a job working on King Kong the Ride for Universal Studios. And he actually staged King Kong the Ride before they implemented it at Universal Studios. He was the project coordinator on that. Just finished last year building Disney Shanghai. He finished all of Fantasyland for them, including the castle. And he's an engineer. And now he does. Disney has his number on speed dial. He met with them twice last month, one on a project in Hong Kong and one on a project in Tokyo. And he is their golden boy right now. And he started out as an engineer working in construction. I told Michael about that. And Michael said, I never even thought of that. He says, that's what I want to do. And so he told me he's going to go design roller coasters because I told him that it was a possibility. I teach these kids to dream because you taught me that I have a right to dream, to become the man that God created me to be. And that's my dream today. I want to be the man that God created me to be. Nothing more, nothing less. Just the man that God created me to be. And if I can touch one life in my journey here, not just here tonight, but in my journey through Alcoholics Anonymous, through this life, if I can touch one life and change that life, maybe that's the person who will change the world. And I believe that those kids that I'm working with right now, I believe that one of the thousand or so of them that I will encounter in the time that I'm there, one of them will change the world. And maybe it'll be because Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the tools to talk to them in a way that I never imagined possible. Everything I am, everything I will ever be, I owe to rooms like this and people like you, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, this beautiful book, the God that you brought to me and promised me would never let me down. You'll hear people say that if God drops you, He'll teach you how to fly. I don't believe that. I believe that if God drops you, you already know how to fly, and you just don't know it. Thank you for letting me share, you guys. Happy New Year.